hope you had a good weekend. Thank you for tuning in today. My name is Hemrick, and this is Red Ice Radio. The website is redicecreations.com, and we're almost at the end of November already. It's amazing. We are rushing towards December. The Bloot and Yule, or Christmas if you prefer, is coming up. It's absolutely insane how quickly the time has flown by this year. Well, today we're talking with Anne Corcoran. She was educated at Rutgers and Yale universities and is a conservative grassroots activist. She was busy raising children and rescuing senior horses on her farm in Western Maryland in 2007 when she learned that the Virginia Council of Churches had been quietly dropping off Muslim refugees in Hagerstown, the county seat of Washington County in Maryland. So she began researching the program, trying to understand better the governmental process of the UN and U.S. State Department Refugee Admissions Program and how it was possible for a nonprofit church group to choose a rural community in another state for resettlement without any local approval or discussion. So to help keep track of what she learned and to help others around the U.S. with the same concerns, she began writing the blog Refugee Resettlement Watch, which has become a very important source, a place for anyone who wished to understand the U.N. federal government initiative to, quote, change cities, large and small, across 48 states. Ms. Cochran also reports on refugee and asylum seeker problems worldwide with a special concern for what is happening to Europe as migrants from the Middle East and Africa flood to European countries. And also in early 2015, the Center for Security Policy Press published her book Refugee Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She has some incredible insight into this question of refugees, asylum seekers, and migrants. So stay tuned for a revealing show. Welcome, Anne. Thank you so much for coming on with us. It's great finally speaking with you. Hope you're doing well today.
Doing very well. Thank you so much for having me on.
You bet. Well, you've done some really important work with the Refugee Settlement Watch, your website, giving Americans an opportunity to learn about the kinds of things that are kept out of the mainstream media when it comes to refugees and immigration and everything else. But you also, of course, touch upon the situation in Europe and the ongoing, well, catastrophe, I would call it, that is being enforced by the governments, the state, the European Union over there. So before we go into some of these aspects and talk both more about America and the EU, tell us why you started the website first. How did a nice lady like yourself get pulled into a topic such as this?
Well, to tell you the truth, what happened is, let me just set the stage. I live on a farm in rural Western Maryland. It's a very conservative county. I have four children and lots of interesting things to do on the farm. The kids are grown up now. But 7 years ago, 8 years ago, actually, in 2007, myself and others, a few other ladies in my county, noticed that refugees were being resettled. And our original introduction to the refugees being resettled was that they weren't being very well cared for. It came to our attention that winter came and these new refugees didn't have coats and blankets and so on and so forth. And I simply wanted to understand, how are these refugees arriving here in this very conservative rural county, in our county seat, which is Hagerstown, Maryland? So I started researching the issue and found out that it was the Virginia Council of Churches. Now, keep in mind, we live in Maryland. It was the Virginia Council of Churches had brought about 200 refugees to start with about the previous year to Washington County and basically dropped them off in some of the worst slums in the city. About 100 of them were Meshkedian Turks, which the United States ended up taking thousands of, and they are Turkish Russian Muslims that Turkey didn't want and Russia didn't want, so we took them. And again, I simply wanted to understand at first why was this happening? Who said it could happen? Who told Virginia Council of Churches they could do this? So I started my research. Our local newspaper did not want to write about this. It was kind of a left-leaning, it still is, a left-leaning newspaper did not want to write about this. So once I started my research, I decided I would write about it. And so I started this blog called Refugee Resettlement Watch. And I have literally been writing this blog for 8 years. I write almost every day. I take off a few holidays here and there. And I've immersed myself in this subject because I feel passionately about it. I think that citizens, the gist of what I think, is that citizens have a right to know what the federal government has planned for their communities, and we have a right to say something about it. And so again, I just educate people around America through my blog and around the world now, because what is happening in Europe is a harbinger of what could happen here if we're not careful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely right. So the Council of Churches, why do they push this? And tell us a bit more about who actually benefits from this.
Yeah, the Virginia Council of Churches, they may not even actually be in existence anymore. I'm not sure. I mean, they may not be resettling refugees. I'm not sure. They worked for let's take a step back. What I learned was that the United Nations is picking most of our refugees. They come into the country. The U.S. State Department then divvies them up between 9 major federal resettlement contractors. Virginia Council of Churches was a subcontractor of Church World Service, which is one of the 9 biggies. They are paid literally by the head to resettle refugees, which is always a shock when people find out that these big quasi-supposedly religious organizations like Church World Service or the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops or the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, that they are all being paid by the federal government, by the U.S. taxpayer, to resettle refugees to about 185 to 190 cities in the United States. Virginia Council of Churches was just a subcontractor of Church World Service, and we're being paid to bring them here.
That's strange. I mean, obviously we should point out not every refugee that's coming in is Muslim, but many are, particularly in Europe, of course. So why would a Christian organization be doing it? It would be go against their ideology, right?
Because they're being paid to do it. I hate to say it. It's such a crass a thing, but it's about, in this case, well, it's about money. I don't know if I can get into their larger intentions, but you know, the Council of Churches around the world are very hard left, politically leaning. You know, we remember years ago, maybe you don't, there was all this talk about the religious right. Well, there is a religious left, and I think at the leadership level, they would like to see to bring in more left-leaning voters. Immigrants generally vote Democrat. I think it's about bringing in more voters for the Democrat Party. I think it's about this whole business that the left is into of trying to break down borders around the world, that we should have a borderless world. I think there's a drive for that. One of the things that happens in each of these communities, and it happens with Virginia Council of Churches here too, is that there are churches where there are well-meaning, nice people who think that this is just a wonderful thing to do, and they don't see the bigger picture. So they have volunteers working for them who help the refugees, and that's all good. The refugees need lots of help. But they don't see the bigger picture, I don't think, of what's happening behind it, what the driving forces behind all of this.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. We'll get into more of that and talk more about that. But it seems, I mean, if we look at the Pope, obviously, the doctrine he's advocating these days is a kind of a universalism. But what's strange to me, again, I can't speak for the entire situation in America because I don't know if everyone there is Muslim, but it seems to me that a left liberal progressive agenda, which is pushed by most countries in Europe these days, a social democratic agenda, would not really be something that many Muslims who are very conservative in their own traditions are interested in, right? They wouldn't necessarily vote left.
Well, yes, they do. And they do here in America for sure.
Right.
The Council on American Islamic Relations, probably the most vocal of the advocacy groups for Muslims in America, is very tied into the Democrat Party. Very much so. And it's kind of almost beyond my level of understanding, but I think it's like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I think that's what's going on right now. I think the hard left, even the Marxist left, the communist left, mm-hmm. and the Islamic extreme views or whatever, I'm not talking about the Muslim who just, you know, wants to lead his life and not be bothered with anything else, but the political Muslims are tied together with the hard left. And I often wonder what's going to happen one day if they succeed in getting rid of all the conservatives, I mean, which of them is going to end up on the top in the end? Because they, because just what you're saying, many Islamic principles don't really fit with hard left ideas of, say, gay rights or
exactly.
that
yeah.
sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I can't speculate.
we talk about this these double standards and contradictions a lot on the shows. I wanted to ask you about it. But we'll talk more directly about some of the things that you found. We're kind of speculating a bit now. But one of the things I do want to mention before we go there is the underlying agenda, because I think it changes over time as well. Because for a while, many of these people were considered to be, like economic migrants. They wanted to come to the West to get a better life. It was a human right by everyone to be able to, live like everyone does in the West, pretty much. So our borders are open. In another instance, they are obviously fleeing from war-torn countries, despite that we've seen many other nations, not only Syrians, actually a majority of other nations or other people from other nations coming into Europe now during the migrant crisis. So that doesn't really hold water either. And yet another explanation has been referring back to a report that the United Nations released in the year 2000 about replacement migration, that they proposed this as a solution to what they call a declining and aging population. And they ran through basically all of the Western world, Europe, America, and I think they included Japan and Korea and Russia in this too. And the latter three there obviously haven't done what America and Europe has done. But this is yet another explanation and underlying that low fertility and mortality rate is basically causing us to have a declining population. So we need to import people to replace us, right?
Oh, see, I don't buy that. I know you're exactly right that that's what the United Nations has been pushing for decades or whatever. I've been telling American patriots, get busy if you're young and have lots and lots of children.
Absolutely, yeah.
and I feel sorry for Europe because of this. I mean, years ago, I read Mark Stein's America Alone. You probably read that book. And with the data in it about low fertility rates in Europe, I mean, if I were running a country in Europe, I would tell people just get busy now. You better start having babies now because your beautiful blonde Swedish girls are not going to last forever.
Well, I know. Well, exactly. And politically, there are certain things that they can do to incentivize this and make it easier. And yes, it has occurred in certain Nordic countries. But I think we don't have to go too deep into this now. But I think underlying this is an issue of both guilt and morality somehow weaved into this. That if we look at the ideas of white privilege and white guilt and all these kinds of things, I think that is partially contributing to the fact that a lot of young people don't want to have children because they feel somehow that they are the root cause of all the evil in the world. That's to a certain extent, not exaggerating, that's what academia and much of the mainstream media is pushing in a roundabout way these days.
Yes, well, our educational system, we could change that if we had the will to change that whole concept either in Europe or here. The other thing, I'm old enough to remember when I was in college and graduate school and all of that, I was told that I had to just have two children because of the world population problem.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I bought it. I have four children, but I adopted two. But I bought it, as did many other well-educated American men and women. We bought this idea we should only have two children to replace ourselves. But I'll tell you what, the other folks didn't buy it. You know what I mean? It's not in the minority communities. They didn't buy this idea. We bought.
Exactly. We took the responsibility, right, to a certain extent of picking up on what we were being told about being a drain on the planet and the environment and global warming and all kinds of excuses, right?
I was really dumb, really dumb. I wish I were young enough to have six.
Yeah, yeah. Listen to that, you ladies and men who are listening. Everyone should listen to that. I think that's an excellent advice. And I mean, it's kind of turning into a population warfare. I don't know what to call it, but it's very strange. And we have predictions or projections now in places like Africa that there are going to be about 4 billion at the end of the century. I don't think that's going to happen. I think we're going to have a population collapse before that in terms of resources. What do you think?
Well, I think to some degree, yes. But if Europe keeps opening its doors, and America too, but to a less degree. But if Europe keeps opening its doors, they're just gonna flood out of Africa and go wherever they can get stuff. I mean, what's to stop them now? What is to stop them? I mean, it's really shocking and scary. We should, at some point, I'd like to talk about the difference between the refugee resettlement program in America and what's going on in Europe right now with the sort of the flood, the migration flood. Now, we have some migration flood into the United States over the southern border, obviously.
Yeah.
But we don't, and we do get some, obviously, other than Mexicans. I mean, just this week, there are these Syrians that are working their way up through Mexico, we're told, and showing up at the U.S. southern border. But the refugee resettlement program in the United States, the word refugee here has a very specific meaning, and it involves those who can prove that they've been persecuted abroad somewhere for race, religion, political persuasion, or belonging to a specific persecuted group, like, for example, homosexuals. And then we select those refugees from that group, and running from war is not considered a reason to be called a refugee. We select those refugees, the United Nations basically tells us which ones to select, and we fly them into the United States. And that's different from the asylum-seeking system that's going on in Europe right now with the flood of migrants where they come in, or they come to our southern border as well, and they ask for asylum. Somalis have come to our southern border and crossed the border and said, now I want asylum. Likewise, others have too. Chinese are the biggest asylum seekers in the United States, where they get in here in various ways, and then they ask for asylum. But it's kind of different than there. I just want to straighten out the terminology a little bit.
Yeah.
And here, when a person comes in and says, I'm going to be persecuted, please give me asylum, and they are given that asylum, they become an asylee, or quote-unquote a political refugee, but they get all the benefits that a refugee gets who has been brought in here, has been flown in here. Does that make sense?
Sure, yeah, it does. Well, one of the tricky parts here, too, and I guess this might be more true in Europe right now than in America, but obviously, how can you confirm that they really are they are refugee, or that they are entitled to seek asylum? Because if they come here without passports, papers, etc., how can we confirm who they are, where they come from, right?
Right, that's a big problem, right? Obviously, that's a big problem for all of us, but a big problem for Europe. I mean, who are these people, and how do you? Are we going to just? I mean, the assumption is we're just going to ask them, and that they're going to be truthful. And if I were trying to get into a first world country from a third world country, I might not be exactly truthful either. So that surely they are not going to. If you say to them, well, are you being persecuted? They're going to say yes. If I went home, I would be persecuted.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, it's a big problem. And when in fact in Europe, I'm guessing that the largest percentage of those people flooding into Europe right now are economic migrants. They're not being persecuted somewhere. They just need jobs and money and a home and all of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. They're jumping on the opportunity.
Yes, but that doesn't make them a refugee.
No, no. Okay, so let's get into this a bit more in detail in terms of what you've found. Let's talk about the United States. There you've looked into many different states, many different small towns in certain areas, and it's almost like I don't know where to begin. There's so many things you have detailed over the years, but is there a couple of examples that you can bring up of cases that is near memory-wise to just to give the listener an idea of what is happening here and what is happening in America overall.
Yeah, let me just go over this structure of the program, too, because that's the part that was why I tell people all the time when they're starting to learn about this issue that it's important that they understand the process, because you can't sort of work on ways to reform it until you really understand it, either reform it or get rid of it. But you can't really tackle it until you understand the process. So, as I already said, the United Nations picks these refugees from different places in the world. And we can talk about why they're picking refugees in certain places. Some of it makes sense and some of it doesn't, honestly. And let me say, too, that one of the driving forces, this isn't all just a sort of a left-wing bringing the Democratic voters. One of the other big driving forces on the right, is that there are big corporations that need cheap, reliable immigrant labor. And so they are very often the people pushing, for example, Jeb Bush is for, you know, amnesty for illegal aliens, and he hasn't come out against the Syrian refugee issue at all yet.
Yep.
And because, honestly, he is working with those big money people in the donor class, if you will, who need the reliable, cheap immigrant labor. So that's one of the factors that's driving this. It's not just the hard left wanting more voters or wanting to get rid of borders or whatever. But so what the problem is, of course, it leaves the poor average American working guy who sees this as a, you know, a competition for jobs at that level. It leaves them kind of squashed in the middle there.
Absolutely.
So the structure is then these nine contractors, which I mentioned earlier, every week get together at the U.S. State Department offices, and they divvy up the refugees that are coming in, the cases that have been processed abroad and are coming into the United States. And they parcel them out to different cities and towns across the country, depending on all sorts of factors, which include whether there's others of their ethnic group in the community already, whether they have staff who speak certain languages on board already, whether there's a sufficient supply of subsidized housing available, government-funded housing, whether the school system is equipped to deal with more children from different ethnic groups speaking different languages, and so on and so forth. So they sit down, but I don't know if you saw this week, the governors called the White House. There was a conference call. Many of these governors who are critical of the Syrian issue right now called the White House, and they wanted a heads up as to where these refugees were going to be going, not just the Syrians, but any of them.
Mm-hmm.
They're told they couldn't have that information. But keep in mind, these are nonprofit groups, these contractors, these church groups. They have the information when the governor can't have the information. So the refugees are distributed around the country, and what is happening and started happening in where I live, can't say we started it because there were people who had conflicts in other towns before I got involved, before 2007. But the towns like mine became what the federal government actually calls a pocket of resistance. And I found it incredible that a federal office of refugee resettlement actually called us like pockets of resistance.
Yeah, it is like, insurgents or something in a war terminology, you know?
Oh, war terminology, pockets of resistance. I kind of took it as kind of a badge of honor, you know? But anyway, so there are some communities in the United States now that are saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. And when I say communities, citizen activists mostly, and in some cases the mayors of cities are saying, whoa, we're overloaded. You've got to stop sending them. Manchester, New Hampshire has 80-some languages in the school system, and I'm told that's not the worst city. So it's very expensive to run school systems when you have children speaking so many different languages, and you have to get the special teachers and so on and so forth. You've got some communities overwhelmed with the number of refugees with illnesses. For example, when I first got into this, Fort Wayne, Indiana had a huge influx of Burmese refugees. Now, the Burmese are mostly Christians, but we are now bringing Burmese Muslims in. But they had a huge influx of Burmese refugees who had tuberculosis. And so the local health department had to deal with all these TB cases. Now, these weren't the refugee resettlement agencies will be quick to say, well, yes, but they weren't active TB. They were latent TB. Well, that may be so, but many of those people had to have medication and had to be kept on their medication to make sure it didn't turn into a more serious form of tuberculosis. And then some communities have big problems with not having enough government-subsidized housing. So you have American citizens, American handicapped people, American elderly people who can't get on a list to get a subsidized apartment because the refugees have got the list all filled up. So conflicts have developed in a bunch of cities. One of them right now is Twin Falls, Idaho.
Yes.
And people would think, well, Idaho, what's going on in Idaho? Well, Idaho has long been a resettlement state, and Twin Falls is a smaller city. Not Boise is really filled with refugees, and then Twin Falls is a smaller city that's gotten a bunch of refugees. And when you look closely, you find out, meatpacking plants. Chobani Yogurt has a huge facility in Twin Falls, Idaho. That's what's happening. You've got the resettlement contracting agencies working with big companies to bring in the labor.
Wow.
So what I'm encouraging people to do is, if you're trying to figure out where you want to live, don't live near where there's a meatpacking plant, for example. That's a lot of what happened in Minnesota, up in, you know, Michelle Bachmann's district, is St. Cloud, Minnesota area, you know, when she was still a congresswoman. They just flooded the place with Somalis, and it has to do with these turkey, Genio, and other turkey processing plants, and the Somalis came in to work at the plant. Of course, then the Somalis caused big problems because they demanded special prayer break times, especially during Ramadan, which changed, the time changes every night, so it caused a big disruption in a lot of these meatpacking plants for a number of years. I wrote about this.
Oh, gosh.
Because you can't shift the schedules that well. And then you had these, you literally had in some of the meatpacking plants in Colorado, you literally had the other ethnic groups, the Vietnamese, the Mexicans, and all that, complaining bitterly that why were their break schedules changing every night based on the Somali need to pray?
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Of course.
So, anyway, so now there are these pockets of resistance, and there are a number of them around the country, and citizen activists are starting to communicate with each other, which is a good thing, and helping each other around the country. Spartanburg, South Carolina, they're a big pocket of resistance.
Yeah.
And another thing that's happening in South Carolina that's interesting to me, and I think this is the way to go, is some county councils, some of the citizen activists who are concerned about refugee resettlement are making presentations to county councils and trying to get resolutions in advance, even before the county has any refugees, and saying, we don't want any refugees here. Of course, here's the biggie. This is a federal program. And the way it was written initially by Ted Kennedy and Joe Biden and Jimmy Carter, back in 1980, the way it was written, it sets it up as a federal program that gives very little role to Congress at all and virtually no role to state governments to say no. So
obviously we have lobby groups from a lot of these industries in place, obviously having a finger in the pie here and say, this is what we want. We don't care about the American worker anymore. We don't, you know, we're a transnational corporation or whatever, and they just see fit to increase their profits. So this is, you know, improving things for them, basically.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And when you look into some of the history of these, some of these big meatpacking companies out west, you find out they're not even American companies.
Right. Yeah.
I think Swift is Brazilian. I could be wrong on that, but I think when I researched it back a few years ago, Swift and Company was Brazilian. So here you have these big companies, you know, doing business in America. We get the refugees. And here's the thing. If you were creating a business model for this, you can see why this is sensible to them. The refugee gets paid, you know, maybe a little bit above minimum wage. But the rest of the refugee's family is being supported through various welfare programs. Refugees are a different category of legal immigrant to America. If you're a legal immigrant, you know, you got in line, supposedly, you know, or maybe you married an American and you're waiting in line to get your, you know, citizenship or whatever, you can't access welfare.
No.
But refugees can access welfare the minute they arrive. And that is the job of these resettlement contractors. Like Virginia Council of Churches operating in my county, what their job was is they get the refugees their medical care. They sign them up for all their welfare, for food stamps, get the kids in school, find them an apartment that's subsidized by the government. And in 3 months, that resettlement agency, Virginia Council of Churches, moves on to another batch of incoming refugees. And those first refugees are supposed to be self-sufficient. Well, they aren't self-sufficient. There's no way you can support a family of, you know, 4, 5, and 6 or whatever on the salary of one working member of the family who's working at a meatpacking plant or some other warehouse. In our county, it was kind of warehouses that needed, you know, grunt workers to move things around in warehouses and stuff. So this taxpayer then, local and federal taxpayer, supports some of the other expenses of the family. So you can see where the meatpacker would even, or a big corporation, wouldn't even have any qualms about this. I mean, this is a perfect deal for them.
It's incredible, though, when you put this in perspective, because, you know, you have of course, a lot of different things happening at once here. So it's just not the one thing. But let's just examine what this is creating, because the left obviously also want to, for example, increase the minimum wage, right? So, and despite that, they want to try to end poverty and focus on statistics that show that it's very unequal when it comes to education and income and these kinds of things. Despite that, though, so that's a desire to end those things. They are importing people that are poor. They're importing poverty. They're importing people that will be, in some cases, a burden on the healthcare system, as you said. There will be a low education level. All of these issues, or just a few of these issues, obviously conflict with this very idea then of trying to end those things while you advocate to bringing more of those into America, right?
Yes, and the problem that you have right now is that you're being very logical.
We can't be that, right? So, yeah.
No, but let me just point out, I don't know if you're familiar with the Cloward and Piven strategy.
Yes, I certainly am. Yeah.
Yes. And so, for those listening, the bottom line is the concept, these were two professors at Columbia University, and the concept is to overload the welfare system to bring on the revolution, to crash the system.
Yeah, so they're a new type of warrior in the class warfare structure of Marxism, basically.
Yes, exactly. So the idea is to crash the system and rebuild their own system out of the ashes of the crash system. And see, here is my thinking on how the shift came to this immigrant thing. This is just my speculation on the issue. I can remember young and had a liberal father who was very concerned about the poor in Appalachia of the United States, American poor, living in the hills and mountains of West Virginia and so on and so forth. But I think what happened to those people, I mean, there probably still are pockets of poverty. I can't say for sure, but I don't think it's the same as the children of those people broke away, got some education, maybe they joined the military, they got a better life. They were moving up into the middle class. And so these people who wanted to bring on the Marxist Revolution or whatever didn't have enough poverty left in America to keep fighting this issue and to bring down the system to buy Cloward and Piven. So they had to start importing the poverty. I think that's where the whole big push came, to start bringing immigrants into the United States from everywhere, from Central America, from Mexico, from South America, and now from around the world, to import poverty to break down the system. But you could never tell what are these church people, like the Virginia Council of Churches, they think you were nuts if you said such a thing.
So this is really where the left, the cultural Marxist, and all this kind of they converge with big business on this point. Then, really interesting.
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, it's fascinating to me. I mean, I wonder, do they actually get in a room and talk about this together, or is it two parallel tracks? They're each going for their own goal, completely separate from each other. And the part that makes me the angry, well, there's a lot of parts that make me angry, but one of the main parts that make me angry is that they all get to march along wearing this white hat of humanitarianism.
Exactly.
So they lord it over on the rest of us that they are doing the good Christian duty and the wonderful things, and the rest of us are just mean, hard-hearted, xenophobic bigots. Because we question it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, just because we want to have self-determination and try to not be replaced in our own countries. That's it's remarkable. But isn't... Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, just that little thing. We don't want to be replaced. It's really that simple.
That's what it is, exactly. And furthermore, if we're such horrible racists, then why do these people want to live with us?
Well, that's another good question, too. But, my view is that there's sort of no logic in this, so there's no sense even trying to have a big discussion about the logic of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That if we want to keep our conservative ideals and not be taken over and so on and so forth, we have to just figure out how to fight it on a political level. and try to win, as opposed to, I don't think the left is sitting around, to tell you the truth, having philosophical discussions as much as we do.
No. It's just emotional appeal all the time. That's how they disarm us and win the arguments, by pointing fingers, calling us names, and then saying that we have the moral high ground. But the fact is they don't, because this is an utterly despicable tactic, in my view, of being on par with... Well, look at how the left lined up when there was... when the Chinese tried to replace the Tibetans, right? And when there was an invasion of Chinese into Tibet, everyone was lining up to be part of showing, signaling to each other of how horrible this is. But no one is standing up for us.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's exactly right.
So isn't Obama looking at using also HUD, the Housing and Urban Development, for... It's now being called, I believe, basically racist zip codes, that they're actually targeting neighborhoods that are, quote, too white, unquote, and that these are being targeted for placement of refugees, right? That there's somehow there's a problem if there's too many white people in one area, and this needs to be remedied with vibrant diversity, right?
Yes. Obama did put this process in place a couple of years ago, and they just came out with their report earlier this year. It was called his Task Force on New Americans. And the idea is just what you're saying. He wants to diversify and use the power of government to diversify communities that are not sufficiently diverse. Now, one of the things on this refugee thing that ties into this, in 2013, I went out to Pennsylvania for an Office of Refugee Resettlement meeting. It was the contractors, these organizations resettling refugees, and the federal government were having sort of a day-long powwow, and, you know, I just signed up and went. But one of the presentations was by an organization called Welcoming America. Well, it turns out Welcoming America is a contractor, another contractor that the federal government hired, and it was originally funded with some funding from George Soros, so you can tell where that's
from.
And Welcoming America had a little presentation, a little slide presentation, and on the screen they put a picture of a little plant growing in soil, and they said that the immigrants are the seedlings that they are planting in the soils of American communities.
Right,
and I'm not kidding.
Right.
Had a little picture of a little seedling and the soil, but they made it very clear that they were not using the word assimilation,
mm-hmm.
and that they that the soil, Welcoming America's goal was to have the soil change to accommodate the seedling. The seedling was not coming to become an American. It was the soil of the, which is the community, had to change to accommodate the seedling,
mm-hmm.
and they had that on a little slide. That was my first introduction to this whole idea that ended up being this task force on new Americans, because Welcoming America played a huge role in that. And Welcoming America's job, part of its job, is to go around the country and try to tamp down any pockets of resistance starting to build up in various communities around the country. So,
yeah.
Indeed, the HUD, what you're talking about, the HUD housing and all of that, Obama's trying to put that all in place so that communities will be given rewards, essentially, of HUD money, for example, if they do the right thing and start to diversify. But here's where it gets sort of disgusting, is that in these small communities, you have developers working with the local county government, you know, hand in glove, and the developer sees all this federal money coming and says, hey, I want to build this new apartment complex with HUD money. And so that you end up with this, again, this whole money thing going on between local corrupt government. I shouldn't say they're all corrupt, but, you know, local government officials, some of whom may be corrupt, working with developers because they're not looking at the big picture. They don't have the view that you and I have about what this is doing. They only see it as, oh boy, we've got millions of HUD dollars coming to our town to build this apartment building.
Yeah. Well, this is just short-term thinking, as we know, obviously, because at the end of the day, this will be an intense financial drain on the entire system. And if these people cannot, get jobs, or let's say that the rest of the family is not working, maybe the man managed to get a job at one of these meat, you know, packing plants or whatever. But at the same time, if they're pushing for increased minimum wage or whatever, you might look at a situation where some of these companies would just eventually move abroad or something anyway. And then America is standing there to take care of all these people that can't be integrated into the system. On the long term, this is national suicide, in my view.
I tell you, I think that this issue of immigration, we'll just keep it on America now because we could talk about Europe again, but for America, I think this issue of immigration is the most important issue that this country will face. How we deal with it, with the numbers and where they are coming from, is the most important issue we will face since our founding, by far.
Yeah.
Any of these other things that we get anxious about, whether it's Common Core or Obamacare or other things that citizens are working very hard on, don't amount to a hill of beans if the demographic makeup of the United States changes dramatically, or even less than dramatically. If it begins to change too much, I think it's the most significant issue that we face, maybe ever. Forever.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I mean, you guys are supposed to celebrate that you're becoming a minority in your own country that was built by you. But I think it's built on this premise, or this false premise, that, you know, let's bring up some of those these cliches that they mentioned to us, right? America is a nation of immigrants, right? So, ergo, that's justifying everything that's happening right now, because when the pioneers came from Europe, they obviously too could go straight to the welfare office and line up for some gives me that, you know. But that's just, it's not the same. You can't compare it on that level. It's two different worlds.
Yes. Well, here's the thing that people don't remember. By the way, I have a father who came on the boat from Ireland, and he had to go to work. And he came because, and there was family here to take care of him. There was an uncle who had come ahead and was taking care of him and had to sign for him. And he had to go to work. There was no welfare system. When those early immigrants, earlier than my father even came, there was no welfare system.
No.
They either had to, their families had to take care of each other. If they didn't get a job, if they didn't, whatever, they had to go back to where they came from, and many did. And we forget that. And then there was this big gap from the 20s, I don't know the exact date, late 20s to 1964 or 5, where we cut our immigration numbers dramatically. And that was because they weren't assimilating so much, because there were so many of them, they couldn't really assimilate in the 20s, early 1900s. So we actually dramatically reduced our immigration. So when they say we're a nation of immigrants, it's like, what are they talking about? We had for about 40 years of slowed immigration, and it was only Ted Kennedy with that Immigration Nationality Act or whatever it was called.
The Hart-Celler Act or whatever. Yeah.
That opened all of that up again. And the big difference is when that law went into place, it encouraged immigration from countries that are not like us. Most of the immigrants were Europeans. They were like us. Tradition and so on and
yep.
so forth.
Yeah. Now it's completely incompatible cultures in some cases.
Yes.
And of course, America and Americans, white America or European Americans, are somehow also now ending up in a position not only where they are to take care of all these people, but to kind of meddle in the or try to preserve the peace against these rivaling ethnic groups that are coming into America, who are obviously just simply pushing for their own interests. This is the logical thing, because this is what people do. But as soon as European Americans are pushing for their interests, my God, be careful. The KKK is around again, you know?
That's right. As a matter of fact, when you think that the left, the people that adore this idea of more immigration to America, have absolutely no problem. Let me just tell you a little story about in my community. At the same time that the refugees were coming, there was a church in my town. The Virginia Council of Churches lorded this over on us. Well, there's a church in your town that's taken an African family, and as if somehow that was to make us look bad,
Right.
And it was like, that's fine. Let them take African family and take care of them. There was no problem with that. But that African family didn't last very long in our white town, because the mother went out to Minnesota and met lots of other Africans and decided that she wanted to live out there. And the next thing you knew, the whole family was leaving this church that had been so nice to them here in our white community. And they were going out to Minnesota to live with other Africans.
Of course, yeah.
And everybody, the left would say, well, yes, of course, what's wrong with wanting to live with your own kind? But goodness knows, can you imagine me saying, I want to live in a community of Irish people, Irish ancestry, or I want to live in a community, my mother's German, I want to live in a community with just German people. Can you imagine what kind of hell would be rained down upon my head.
Oh, yeah.
To think.
I know.
But it's not, it's completely understandable when in Dearborn, Michigan, Iraqis want to live with other Iraqis.
Of course.
It's yeah. understandable. But yeah. why is that, why the double standard? Why can't you live
with well, exactly. And then it also, you figure out pretty quick that this line of you know, diversities of strength or whatever doesn't really apply either, because it isn't about, well, at least not at this stage. I mean, who knows where this will go in the future. I have a sense that cultures overall will actually begin to, you know, erode, and it will kind of merge into one thing. So all this multiculturalism in a weird kind of way will become a monoculture. But that's, I think that's later down the road. As of right now, as you say, there's no implication that there needs to be assimilation into culture. This has become a very, very, like a dirty concept now, that no, you should respect their culture. They should live however they want in our countries. So basically all that's happening is you get pockets and zones of other cultures within your culture while you can't propagate and encourage your own culture.
Right. And let me just tell you, there's actually, even within this refugee program, there are incentivizing separation, because our Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement gives grants to organizations they call ethnic community-based organizations, or ECBOs, they call them. There's also another name for them, the ECBO. And so, in other words, federal grants go to the Vietnamese community of Oakland, California, or the, I'm making these names up, I don't know, or the Somali community of St. Cloud, where there's a local grassroots group of just Somalis, and they're getting federal grants. And those grants go toward helping their people, and I put their people in quotes, helping their people get their stuff.
Yes.
And they help. It's like, do you remember the whole controversy about Acorn when Obama first came to office?
Yes.
Acorn was a community organizing group. And basically, they helped people in poor people in cities, you know, get their welfare benefits and all of that. But they also helped them register to vote and actually, you know, help them get to the polls and all of that sort of thing. Well, that's what these ECBOs do. I mean, they work on helping their people, whether it's Somali, Iraqi, Vietnamese, whatever,
yeah.
Hmong. So, you know, so we're actually funding their continued separation and lack of assimilation. We're funding their separation.
These are colonies within the Western world, right? So it was horrible when we did it, and we never want to see anything like that again. But in this case, I can't compare it to anything else, right? Because people can have a sense of, you know, Western intervention into, let's say, North Africa and the Middle East. That's a bad thing. We don't want that. But Middle Eastern and North African, you know, incursion into the West, that's not a problem whatsoever. That's perfectly fine, right?
This is a colonization definitely going on. There's no question about it, in this direction and in Europe.
And you see what's so, and you know, aggravating about this to me is that what's happening now demographically is that European nations, America, Australia, New Zealand, any country that has been founded and built by European people is experiencing the same measures here, basically. And so what is happening is that our countries are demographically being permanently altered, and there is no country where we can have just our own country and just our own culture and encourage that for where it is. Now, it's being shattered, broken up. We're being, in that sense, truly divided, because we can no longer just advocate for our own interests. But no matter how, you know, problematic it might be from some of the countries that these people flee from, and I don't, you know, obviously, it's a shame that things are bad in their countries, right? But there's other ways of helping these people and deal with these problems. But my point is, they still have a country that is theirs, that is exclusively theirs, that have their people in it, and that they always could return back to if and when things either improve or they just feel like it. But that's not the case for us Europeans. We have nowhere to go.
Right. I often think about, can you imagine if Americans or anywhere in Europe said, well, I think we're just going to go set up a colony in Somalia.
Right, you know, exactly.
Go there and set up a colony and, you know, start growing food and doing this and doing that. And we expect certain things from the Somali government, as poor as it is, to take care, help, you know, help us get started, maybe give us some land and so on and so forth. Can you imagine the hell that would break loose?
Well, of course. Exactly. And think about it. I mean, we should, it's almost like I wish that this could be done just to show the double standards and say, you know, the people who were coming in started saying, you know what, we are the Somalis, you know, we are the Somalis now. We need to be on your television shows. We need to be within your political system. We need to push our interests. We need, you know, whatever else that is currently ongoing in this way, just to demonstrate the double standards that we white Europeans are being held to a completely different standard than everyone else. So it's not about equality, is it?
No, it's not. I shouldn't laugh about it because it's very sad.
I know.
But I do
yeah.
want to mention something. There is a country that is trying really, really hard to keep its culture, even in spite of the fact that they have a low birth rate, and that is Japan.
Yes.
Japan is being hounded daily by the United Nations to take in refugees, and they just aren't doing it. They've taken a tiny number. I mean, and when I say tiny, you know, like 50 Burmese or something like that.
Oh, was it even that much? I thought it was like 4 or something. No, maybe that was Qatar or something. That's right.
It was 50 over a number of years. But
right.
The bottom line is they brought a few, after huge pressure by the United Nations and the international left, huge pressure. They did bring in a few, but they put them through such rigorous acculturation training. I mean, they had to, I don't know how many months it was, where they had to learn the language, they had to learn the culture and the history of the country. And
awesome.
So Japan is trying to save itself and has not bought this idea of the, you know, that they're not having enough children, so therefore they have to import them.
Yeah.
You know, My friend Jim will say, well, you know, the United Nations told us all we had to stop having kids. And then in order to make up for the fact that we didn't have kids, now we have to take the immigrants.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. It's a nefarious tactic because at the very least, and they would at least admit to their errors, right? But they haven't. They haven't said, we're sorry, we were wrong. Actually, you should have a lot of kids. So, but I mean, the long-term implication of that too, though, is that we should just be able to have, and it needs to be a endless growth, basically, right? For the economies to work, for all of this to work, let's project seriously, like 300-400 years into the future, of everyone just having more and more and more and more children. That's obviously not a solution to the problem. They're already talking about resources being sparse, topsoil depletion, food is being, you know, in that case, not as nutritious. It's becoming a problem. So I don't hear about the environmental agenda anymore at all, do you?
Oh, no. And, you know, that's very interesting. You should bring that up. Because wouldn't you think in America that the environmental organizations would be first in line to say, whoa, 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 we can't take all these immigrants? Because when you take all these immigrants, you're going to need more roads. You're going to need more schools. You're going to need more houses built. You're going to have more crowded national parks.
Yep.
You're going to have not enough water. You're going to have this. Wouldn't you think the American environmental movement would be right out in front on this, on the side of slowing immigration?
Yes.
And they aren't.
No.
And that's because the American environmental groups have gone very hard left, and that's more important to them than this is another case of just outright hypocrisy. I mean, how can they tell the rest of us we have to take care of the environment, and yet they're willing to just willy-nilly let millions of immigrants in? It makes no sense.
Yeah, and they all have some kind of human right to a lifestyle and a life that everyone in the West leads.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not going to work. But let's face it. I mean, there are a list of priorities, a hierarchy of these priorities, I think, within the cultural Marxist agenda right now. And I think that's why the Trump card, not the Trump card, but the highest agenda is basically replacement of European people. And so anything else that kind of is subservient to that, they're willing to go along with it, despite that some of these organizations are strictly, apparently, environmental, you know, interests at hand. So.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a short break here in just a minute or so, and then we'll continue to talk more. I have so many more things I want to ask you about. It's an excellent conversation. Very interesting to hear about the work and the research that you've been doing over the years here. I do want to also, of course, help to give a shout out to your book, Refugee Resettlement and the Hijra. Sorry, I don't even know how to pronounce that. The Hijra.
Uh-huh. And,
Exactly. And we haven't even talked about that aspect yet. So that's something I want to ask you more detail about in the next segment. But just tell us a little bit about the book. Tell us where people can get copies of it. And obviously much more of what we've been talking about today is what people can read more about in the book.
Right. It's a little short, easy read book that when I wrote it for the Center for Security Policy that asked me to write it earlier this year, it's really mostly a compendium of like how I got into this and then what I see going forward. And the concept briefly is that Muhammad told his followers to migrate, that was a jihad. Migration is jihad. And that's exactly what is going on right now. That's exactly, the migration is more important. I think the migration is more important than their terrorism jihad. And I suspect that the very bright Islamic extremists or supremacists who would like to take over the world and put Sharia law in place everywhere probably get annoyed every time there's a terrorist attack because it sets back their agenda, their migration agenda.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you might be right. I've heard plenty. Well, actually, let's talk more about that in the second segment. Give us the website. Obviously, we'll add a link to Amazon where people can get the book, but they can also get it through your website. Give us the URL for that.
Oh, yeah, the URL. I can never remember the URL. Just everybody can just Google Refugee Resettlement Watch, and they will find it because I've been around so long, it will pop up. As a matter of fact, just about anything on refugee resettlement, my blog pops up when it's one of the first things you'll find when you go to Google search.
That's right. I have it right here for people who are not online and can search at the moment. It's refugeeresettlementwatch.wordpress.com. We'll have the link to that up. Excellent resource, a lot of good stuff on there. Okay, we'll take a short break here. Stay with us, Anne. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with more.
Hello, this is the IIAP, the Illegal Immigration Assistance Program, a taxpayer-funded division of OAPNUD. For Spanish, press 1, Portuguese 2, Arabic 3, Farsi 4, French 5, Swahili 6, German 7, Italian 8, and if you insist on English, please stand by.
If you're thinking about illegal immigration, be careful when you're choosing the nation, because breaking the law in some countries is frowned upon. Imagine that. Sneak into China, they'll call you a spy, ship you to Mongolia till you die. In the Sudan, they'll hang you and the camel you rode in on. Yeah, and don't go hiking and enter Iran, or you might never be heard from again. And in Mexico, you might face a firing squad. Yeah, forget all about going to North Korea. That's a great example of a bad idea. So when it comes down to it, there's only one option you got. Yeah, come to the USA. There's no penalty to pay should you get caught illegally immigrating. Come to the USA. It will be your lucky day. Cause when you get in, there's lots of goodies waiting. Like healthcare, welfare, free education, help with your voter registration and driver's license and credit cards and license plates for your car. Lots of jobs for you to do and employers who'll turn a blind eye to. Come to the USA. No need to worry about the Constitution. We'll help you start a house of prostitution if that's the kind of work that you want to do. You see, those gringo infidels are crazy. They'll give citizenship to your new baby. So you see, there's really only one choice for you. Come to the USA. There's no penalty to pay should you get caught illegally immigrating. I said, come to the USA. It will be your lucky day. Come when you get in, there's lots of goodies waiting. Yeah, you get public housing and cable TV and food stamps and even government cheese. The borders are a swinging door. Go home for a visit and come back for more. There's sanctuary and amnesty. Bring the whole family eventually. Yeah, come to the USA.
This has been a public service message sponsored by OAPNUD, dedicated to the collapse of the American way of life. Yes.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, don't miss the second hour as we continue to talk with Ann Corcoran about refugee resettlement and the massive changes that this is having on both America and Europe. We talk about the cowardly and traitorous leaders of the West and put some special focus on Merkel in Germany. We ask her to explain a bit more about how the UN is picking refugees from certain places. We also talk about the bill introduced to do background checks on incoming Iraqis and Syrians to avoid letting known ISIS supporters into the U.S. And, of course, the liberals' opposition to this kind of bill. And towards the end, we also get her take on where things are going, both for America and for Europe. Is the future bright or is it dark? So if you want to hear more, don't miss the second hour. We are going to continue at redicemembers.com, our members' website. So go there to subscribe and, of course, get full access to our archives. It's only 15 euros for 3 months. That's 5 euros per month, and it gives you access to over 1,000 radio programs, also videos, inside episodes, and more as we edit. It also helps to keep our website ad-free and a radio show that spares you from commercial interruptions. So do help us expand and get access to a radio show like no other, going where we need to go to expose the lies and dispel the mythmakers. But before we proceed, let me tell you about some of our upcoming guests. We have Piero San Giorgio from Switzerland joining us to discuss how to survive the coming economic collapse. We have Sam Dixon, Matthew Heimbach, and Jack Sen, Gavin Kilgore, and also Pete Papaheracles, together with Victor Thorne from American Free Press. Stay tuned, much more coming. We'll be right back with the second hour with Ann Corcoran, so join us at redicemembers.com.